On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Dr. Robert Kuhn, host of PBS's Closer to Truth.
Let's talk about survival a little bit. It's a topic we've covered a lot on this show because the evidence for it really cuts to the core of this argument we've just been talking about. I mean, if there's consciousness when there's no brain, then it's really debate over.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. It does not follow that if there is more to consciousness than the brain, that there has to be a guaranteed life after death.
Let me be clear. What I was saying is that if there's consciousness with no brain, then the mind-body debate is really over. Who would be someone you would point to as being an NDE skeptic?
To me, the number of people would be legion. Burden of proof is on the other side.
What the evidence suggests pretty clearly in cardiac wards, they know there's no brain electrical activity, and yet there's a conscious experience. I mean, that's really the fulcrum point where this swings.
I would find that not compelling at all, if that's the evidence.
I don't think you've advanced a very good argument as to why that medical evidence should be kind of pushed off the table. But
because you're basically defining brain death as somebody who didn't see an EEG at some point in a contemporaneous way, and I don't think that's the case. I think any time that the brain is later on is alive, it's because it was alive all the time.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on today's episode of Skeptico, we welcome Dr. Robert L. Kuhn, host of Closer to Truth, a rather amazing television show on PBS that you may be familiar with, explores all manners of consciousness, spirituality, a lot of the same topics we cover here, but as you'll see, just because you're covering the same topics doesn't mean that you always come to the same conclusion. Don't want to say too much, but I'll have a couple of comments after the interview. Here's my dialogue with Dr. Robert Kuhn. Today, we welcome the creator and host of one of the most amazing, important, and groundbreaking television programs you'll ever see. And while that may sound like hyperbole, when you consider the topics Closer to Truth has tackled, ranging from ESP to God and religion, mediumship and consciousness research, it's really hard to come to any other conclusion. So, Dr. Kuhn, it's really a pleasure to have you join me today. Thanks for being here on Skeptico.
Thanks, Alex. I look forward to our conversation.
So, there's much to talk to you about. You've tackled so many issues in your show, but I thought where we might start is your bio, because I have to say, when I started researching you and your show, I didn't realize Phi Beta Kappa, John Hopkins, PhD Brain Research, UCLA, MBA Sloan, ran a major international M&A firm, major player in Sino-U.S. business relations, and authored a bunch of books along the way.
You left out my table tennis. So I'm very proud of how I've developed my game in the last year. I have all my coaches are leading Chinese national players, and I'm working very hard on it, even at an advanced age with arthritis in my shoulders. So that to me is the most important part.
See, there you go. Lack of research on my part, not doing a thorough enough research. But seriously, I think it's such an interesting career, and I'm particularly interested in how someone has kept, wow, I was going to say 1 foot in the very materialistic business career, but you've also kept another foot in the academic career, and yet you're exploring these big picture, what we can only describe as spiritual issues as well. Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Sure. As you well say, my love and my passion in life has been to understand fundamental aspects of reality, what it's all about. Many people do. I did, as you say, a doctorate in brain science, actually neurophysiology. And this has been my love my entire life of really trying to understand all aspects of the fundamental aspects of how reality is constructed. And I decided to approach it by understanding the brain, because only through the brain can we understand reality. So that seemed to be one way to get at it. It also embeds all the different sciences, so you really have to learn a lot of science in a lot of different areas, as well as psychology and other aspects to understand it. So that was a wonderful background for me. As you say as well, I do have a parallel life, which I take very seriously, in business, and particularly in the last more than 10 years now, focusing on China and business in China and China political relationships, which has been a something I did not plan for, but came because I was both an investment banker and a scientist, and was invited by the Chinese government in the late 1980s to advise on reform in the science ministries, and that led to a long relationship that evolved in ways that I had not anticipated. Closer to truth, on the other hand, is a lifelong passion. It's something that I actively have a desire to do for literally my entire life. I've continued to follow all the sciences very rigorously. And closer to truth is the expression of my very serious interest and desire to share what I learn with other people. I do not have a prejudiced or a specific agenda that I'm promoting, but see the ways to touch reality in three core areas. One is cosmos, which is an understanding of the most fundamental aspects of physics, astronomy, cosmology. Second is consciousness, which embeds studies of the mind and brain in all different facets. And the third I define with one word, God, which is a search for a fundamental spiritual reality, if such exists. And in the process, it's been great fun for me, and I'm certainly pleased to say that there are a lot of people who think similarly. So, I'm right now, as we speak, I'm editing shows for the next season, which will be in the spring, new season, and very excited to do so. That's certainly a great pleasure in life. I love my business career and my working in China, when I'm doing that almost every night for the last maybe 10 years, I've been I edit these shows as well as spending the time on occasion doing the interviews. But the real work is in the editing and the writing. So that's great fun.
Sure. And I can only imagine how much work it is. Video is so much harder than pure audio. But one of the things I really appreciate about your show is your openness about your struggles with these questions. I don't think you force yourself into this story, but you do reveal along the way some interesting hints about where you've been. For example, that you once believed that you're not a theist. Can you take us through your own spiritual journey, spiritual in the broadest sense, in terms of how you've kind of approached these topics?
Yeah, I'm not terribly different than everyone else. I took a little bit further than others. I certainly was motivated by this understanding and desire for an understanding, and took that in my early life into a doctorate in brain science, because that seemed to be the way to approach it. Took that very seriously in trying to understand all the aspects of mind and brain.
Right, but I was referring more to the spiritual religious part. You were brought up in the Jewish faith. You also considered Christianity.
Sure.
Have you been in the East?
Yeah, I, like many, have done many explorations. I was brought up Jewish, very proud to be Jewish, but didn't necessarily believe in the core reality of the fundamental theology of Judaism, as opposed to the culture and the cultural and ethical and ethnic aspect of it, which of course I do very much. But you know, look to Judaism and to Christianity and to the elements of Christianity, which I explored, particularly from the standpoint of the mind-body problem. That was my fundamental entry into religious thinking, was from the mind-body problem, in the sense of, is there something beyond the human brain that needs to account for the human mind? Because to me, that is the best entry into the fundamental decision: is the physical world all there is? There was a time that I felt strongly that the answer was no, that there must be, from an examination of what the mind is, and the self-awareness and self-consciousness of human beings and to a lesser extent of other animate creatures, something beyond the physical that has to explain that. Many people who have gone through that, analytically, you know, go back and forth on the issues, and that's quite natural. I did and have, but that was my primary entry. And from that, in an early life, I did explore various religious offerings, Christianity in a form, Judaism in a more religious way, not the way the Jewish religion is in terms of its tradition, which is much more an experiential, ethical kind of system. I was never one to feel fulfilled within a ritualistic environment of any religion. You know, maybe that's my problem, which many people have informed me that I need to do. I have tried that, and it didn't take very well with me.
Well, I think I've heard you say you're not a joiner, and I think that I can relate to that, and I also think it makes it hard to really get fully in the spirit of some of those ideas.
And that's right. And people say that to me, that what I do is, you know, has more of an intellectual, and because I'm not in the spirit, in the broadest sense of the term, no matter what the experience is, I do not understand the depth of which people believe in their systems, whatever their system happens to be. It can be, you know, Judaism, Christianity, it can be Eastern religions. And I admit that. That's right. I don't do that, and that's not my specialty. I couldn't do that well.
I wanted to turn you back to the skeptics. It's a topic you touched on a minute ago when you talked about critical thinking. It's also something we've dealt with a lot on this show, interviewing some of the leading figures in the skeptical community, skeptical movement. And I have to say, after doing that for several years, I've kind of come to the conclusion that there's kind of no there. I mean, they come on strong with this science, evidence, this and that, but it really seems like more of a psychosocial phenomena than anything else. What are your thoughts about the skeptical community, the skeptical movement? Do they really bring anything to the science questions?
Well, I hate generalities. I think there is a sociology of belief systems in all aspects of the modern world, and I think it's exacerbated by the internet, because people thought the internet would allow people to get diversity of opinion. Of course, it's there to do, but people don't gravitate to that. People gravitate to their own interests, and therefore the internet has actually pulled people more apart and more diverse. Because people gravitate to their own interests. So you have these social groups that emerge, and you well characterize that. I agree with that. I enjoy the skeptical community very much. We feature many of the major thinkers in that area.
What do you enjoy? That's interesting. What do you enjoy about them?
I enjoy when the best thinkers give their best arguments, because it... to me, the best way to understand, if I hope, which I do, that there is something beyond the physical, the arguments I want to hear are from those who disagree with me, because I fear that my hope will swamp my reason and my own thinking, and that scares me. I do not want to believe in something that is untrue. I don't want to fool. I don't want to fool myself. And the best way to check that is to constantly be dealing with the best thinkers who disagree with you.
Sure, but it all seems so much like apologetics to me. It's like when you talk to Christians like William Lane Craig, I mean, he has some great points on, like you're saying, philosophy, or you want to talk about first cause and that kind of stuff. He can hold his own in these philosophical arguments, but you always feel like there's a Christian apologist there, you know, and Jesus is the way is somehow going to wind up there.
I agree.
And I think the same, I always found the same with the skeptics, the hardcore skeptics, the Michael Shermers, even the Daniel Dennett or Susan Blackmore. I mean, you know what's coming at the end of the day.
I think that's right, but you know, all three are, you know, I count as friends and whose company I would thoroughly enjoy and do enjoy very much. I think that if I want to personally indulge myself in my passion, which is trying to understand reality, that those three names, in fact, four, if you put Bill in there as well, I count them the same way. I mean, I equally enjoy speaking to all of those. That doesn't mean I agree with, you know, the totality of what they say or their conclusions. In fact, I've made a joke, and please take this as a joke, not as seriously, but obviously it's a little point of seriousness. And then as I say that to my skeptic friends, like Michael Shermer, I said, you know, I agree with everything that you say. All your arguments I agree with. The only thing I disagree with is your conclusion. And, you know, that's a ludicrous statement to make, but it's sort of how I feel. Somebody once asked me what I really believe, and I spontaneously said, again, somewhat tongue-in-cheek and humorously, that I'm a Martin Gardner believer.
And, oh, my.
And, you know, Martin Gardner had the view that, you know, he was a prime skeptic and helped found the skeptic movement and a great thinker in many ways. But at the end of the day, he believed that there was something beyond the physical. I mean, he personally did. He just didn't believe that any of the arguments from religion had any validity. Now, I'm not saying I subscribe to that, but I do say that when I am interested in really discerning reality, I find great comfort in the arguments of the leading skeptics, of smart skeptics, and each one of the three that you mentioned. Michael Shermer, Dan Dennett, Susan Blackmore as examples, each has a different perspective. Each gives a different emotional feel and a different kind of argument and structure. And so with those at that level, I learn something each time I talk to them. Even though you are right in the sense that their conclusion I know ahead of time, but I know everyone's conclusion ahead of time because everybody has that, you know, has a strong position, has a conclusion. I mean, there are even some, you know, Mark Vernon in the UK is what he calls a passionate agnostic. So, I mean, he's not sure. He used to be a Church of England priest, and then he became an atheist, and now he's an agnostic. And so I knew that going to speak to Mark. I mean, but each time, because of the way people think, it enriches my sense of reality when I know that.
What I thought we'd do is let's talk about consciousness for a minute, because you put it front and center in Closer to Truth, and as you just mentioned earlier, that is really where it belongs. I mean, it does at the end of the day boil down to this mind equal brain thing or not mind equal brain something more.
I think that is the fundamental question that human beings confront in terms of the nature of reality. And when you push people, when you push all the people that one talks to, at the end of the day, that is the one area that even scientists would say is an open question.
Yeah, but how open is it really? I mean, when you pushed it on your show, and I heard you went with some of the leading folks who wanted to propose the reductionistic, materialistic view, and you walked away with it in the same position that I think many of the leading scientists are that the irreducibility of it just doesn't really hold up. There's something more there. And those materialistic explanations, I think, fall apart on so many levels with so much research that is coming in from a variety of ways. And I guess I'd ask, you hint that isn't really sufficient for you. Is there more? Does mind equal brain work?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, where I would come is that the answer, you know, still in my life is no, that there needs to be something more that is part of awareness and consciousness beyond what can be represented by neuronal firings and chemicals in the brain. And, you know, I've heard all the arguments on all sides. Am I 100% sure of that? No. But I'm, you know, well over 50% sure that, you know, the brain would never be able to explain the mind. Now, there are different views of what people take and on why that's the case. You don't have to go, some people would go right from there to a personal Western Judeo-Christian God. And that's, you know, that takes many, many leaps of faith and beyond to do that, but that still is the cruxial issue. And you know, my view is that no, you do need more than that. Is it possible that it could? It is possible, but I don't think that any ultimate study of the brain will lead directly as science should. To a prediction or a result of consciousness and awareness.
Let's talk about survival a little bit. Life after death. It's a topic we've covered a lot on this show because the evidence for it really cuts to the core of this argument we've just been talking about. I mean, if there's consciousness when there's no brain, then it's really debate over. And that, of course, brings...
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that, but to be very rigorous in the analysis, it does not follow that if there is more to consciousness than the brain, it does not follow that there has to be a guaranteed life after death. It can follow. It is not excluded, of course. It is a fact in that direction.
Let me be clear. What I was saying is that if there's consciousness with no brain, then the mind-body debate is really over because you don't have a body anymore and you do still have a mind. That debate is over. I agree with you. Survival of a personal consciousness that exists, reincarnation, all the rest, is a whole other leap, as you said, that requires some gaps. But I think, you know, the topic that, of course, we've dug into because it directly addresses these issues is, of course, the near-death experience. And I was very interested to read a blog post of yours titled, Is There Life After Death? And if I can, I want to read you your quote from that and chat about it a little bit. You say, as for NDEs, I've never given the claims credence. They seem more like stress-induced brain physiology caused by lack of oxygen or other such chemical insult or trauma brought about by whatever has caused the near death in the first place. Tell me about that, because I got to tell you, I've interviewed some of the world's leading NDE researchers, physicians, researchers at leading universities, and boy, none of them are saying that. It seems to me like all the evidence points in the other direction. So tell me what you're thinking there.
Well, I don't claim to be an expert. I've not done any personal research myself, but from what I've observed and from my knowledge of brain science in general, to me, a great deal of the NDA data has similar kinds of characteristics, but they all have their own cultural affectations. And so it just seems to be, you know, dreamlike activities that are affected by one's personal state. And you know, there are similarities. People talk about lights and all of that. I can't claim to be an expert. I just don't find, from what I've read, to be terribly compelling that there's something there that is provable. I would think that, that life after death and survival and consciousness is such an overwhelmingly powerful and fundamental aspect of reality, if it were true, that if it were true, we'd see much more obvious representations of it. So, you know, the arguments I'm giving you are not knockdown arguments, but they do inform my own thinking. I can see mechanisms of how NDE can occur without some fundamental reality and just on brain trauma affected by cultural aspects of the individual life. I can see why people like to see that. And then on the other hand, if there were NDE and there were independent spirits or that survive death and hover around or whatever, however you define that, I would think that the evidence of that, because it would be such a powerful part of how the universe is constructed, would be a lot more.
Well, you know, I don't want to push this too far because you are admitting and being upfront about not having dug into it too far, but really all those topics that you've mentioned have been pretty thoroughly investigated. We've had many, many experts on the show. I mean, hypoxia, as you mentioned, you know, the lack of oxygen has pretty thoroughly been addressed. The cultural data that has come in, and there's been some good research on that, actually concludes the exact opposite of what you're saying, that there's really no way to explain the similarities of the experience across culture and the differences that you see in terms of different, you know, if you're Christian, then you might see Jesus, and if you're Buddhist, you might see Buddha, are really the kind of fine-tuning small points where the differences go, but the overwhelming majority of the experience is similar across cultures. So, you know, we can go on and on, but...
Well, human brains are similar. Everybody has, you know, hippocampuses and thalamuses and hypothalamuses.
Right.
You know,
right.
Brains.
But we wouldn't expect to see the same narrative over and over again played in that way. And again, this isn't my personal conclusion. It's the conclusion of the folks who have done the research. And moreover, there just isn't any research that really contradicts any of that. Certainly no clinical research. And the stuff that gets thrown up there, I mean, you look at Sue Blackmore, who, you know, published something 20 years ago. We had her on the show. She admits, I'm not current on the research. I'm not an expert to speak on it. And yet people keep drudging up her stuff. Thoroughly kind of addressed. So I guess the only question I can ask, since you're not familiar with the research, is why isn't this an area you've dug into more, and what would make it not something that you would really be that interested in pursuing from a closer to truth kind of angle?
That's a legitimate question. And, you know, obviously we've touched on it because we do deal with life after death in terms of the religious expressions of it. I do like exploring from religious traditions who believe in life after death what that would mean. So that's something I can focus on, for example, because it's not a question of physical fact as NDE would be, which I am very skeptical of, but rather people's opinion if there is life after death. So we give them that. We assume there's life after death, because then we don't have to deal with the argumentation of whether there is. But I assume there is, to explore what that would mean. And that, to me, is very interesting. It deals with a lot of philosophical theology, the different religions and how they see life after death, the implications of that. To me, that's fascinating. To me, that's much more interesting than a trying to prove it. All I can say is that if the evidence were as obvious as you say it is, then the overwhelming number of people in the world would believe it. And it's in fact, in terms of people who study things, and it's quite the opposite certainly for scientists. You mentioned one psychiatrist. There are, you know, many times that who don't.
Again, I mean, we could dig into it, and I'm happy to explore it. I tell you, I have talked to a lot of the leading people in that area. I don't know who would be someone you would point to as being an NDE skeptic.
To me, the number of people would be legion. The burden of proof is on the other side to say why.
Well, the burden of proof of what? I mean, I think you're jumping into the survival life after death thing, and I'm just saying what the medical researchers are doing, and it's established now. You won't even hear anyone argue the phenomena, you know, NDEs happen.
If you want to say that there are those experiences, sure, people have...
During a time, but the important thing is during a time when...
If you're saying that NDEs, that there are people who go through trauma, that they almost have died and then came back to life, or didn't come back to life, came back to consciousness and had some feelings of different lights or different... That's for sure true. I mean, no doubt about that.
But let me be clear. I mean, what the research, what the evidence suggests pretty clearly in cardiac wards, you know, Dr. Pin van Lommel in the Netherlands, who's a leading cardiologist over there, studied it for 25 years, published in The Lancet. I mean, this is not small potato stuff.
What are you saying? I'm still not sure.
They're in the cardiac ward. They know there's no brain electrical activity, and yet there's a conscious experience. I mean, that's really the fulcrum point where this swings. We can deal with life after death later, but we really have to deal with the fact that there's
saying,
a...
What you're saying is that the brain is dead, but there is conscious experience at the same time. You're not saying there's life after death. Is that your claim?
Well, I'm saying that's really the crux of it, isn't it? That's really the crux of the mind-body issue. If we do have this conscious experience,
you're saying that. Well, I would find that not compelling at all. If that's the evidence, I think the question is a very strong one, and I think I may think your conclusion may be right, but I would not cite your evidence as reason for it.
Unravel that for me. What do you mean?
Well, look, I personally believe that there is more likely than not a need for something beyond the material world as we understand it today to explain consciousness and mind. So in that sense, I likely agree with your conclusion. I would not, though, use as evidence for that the existence of the NDE experience where some cardiologists don't record brain activity at contemporaneously with an experience of a phenomenal experience that the person later reports. I think the physiology of that, even if they don't detect brain waves, is that the brain wasn't dead. And it just, they didn't, I mean, how can you say it was dead? I mean, people have been underwater for 20 minutes or things that don't just seem rational, and who knows what. It may have been very low activity, and, you know, it's just if the person was, had unrecordable brain activity, it doesn't mean if they came back to life, I assume that the brain wasn't dead.
Right, but I mean, and again, I don't know how far we can really push this. We've interviewed, and the guy's a skeptic, one of the leading EEG experts, and the EEG is really a pretty good indicator of what we've correlated with conscious activity. So we can't really appeal to that argument that maybe there's something going on deep inside the brain. It's an argument that skeptics have brought up that really doesn't hold water. So from everything we know about brain...
So what are you saying? The brain was dead and then it came back to life?
The brain was dead at the same time the person was experiencing a vivid, hyper-conscious experience.
So then how did the brain, if it was dead, get back to life?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, that's really the jumping off point for a whole bunch of questions that we might ask.
Yeah, look, I mean, I understand the view. It's just not something one that I personally would put a lot of stock in terms of. I don't base my belief or hope that there is a something beyond the material brain. I don't base it on NDE. I mean, that's just full stop. Could I be wrong? Sure, but I don't think so.
Okay, I don't think you've advanced a very good argument as to why that medical evidence should be kind of pushed off the table, but let's leave...
Because you're basically defining brain death as somebody who didn't see an EEG at some point in a contemporaneous way, and I don't think that's the case. I think any time that the brain is, it later on is alive, it's because it was alive all the time. In some lower level state,
right?
You know, there are many cases where people have no EEGs and you said they're dead and they're not. They come back to life.
Well, that gets into the whole definition of death and clinical death. But we could go on. I've done so many shows on that. I'm not going to belabor the issue. I really need to maybe bring you back to.
It's not an area of my expertise. I certainly will tell you that. But it's not something that I think is terribly meaningful in discerning, you know, what reality is. But I could be wrong.
Well, I got to tell you, I've also talked to many consciousness researchers, including Stuart Hameroff, the University of Arizona, and many others. Near-death experience is front and center in the consciousness debate, and I think that the evidence, the medical evidence, has to be, you know, sorted through one way or another, because it's there and it's collected in a very careful way that we would normally.
Look, I think you're right, and you know, I mean, I could foresee doing a show on that in the future. I absolutely can. That's certainly a good suggestion. We'll put it on our list. I agree.
Okay, that wasn't exactly my point, but that's okay. You know what I thought? What I'm really curious about asking you as we kind of wrap things up, there's a documentary that you've alluded to, and I've seen the trailer of Into God. Looks fantastic. Again, the production quality is super on it. What's the story on the Into God documentary?
Well, you know, that's something that's really on our list to do, but unfortunately our list to do is a long list. And so it's something we is on our plan. We have some preliminary scripts, which really deal with the totality of the subjects that impact on, you know, is there a God and what that would mean. But right now it's not on the front burner because we have a whole bunch of new shows for our new seasons to be doing. So, you know, we hope that that we can do that in the next several years, but no definite date. But, you know, there's just too much to do in the world, and, you know, you do what you can. I hope to be able to do it, but no definite time.
Right. So in the meantime, Closer to Truth, how do people find the show? Tell us a little bit about what they can find on the website as well as on various...
Sure. The website is www.closertotruth, and there's no the in there. There's a very pointed reason why there's no. It's not the
right.
Truth. It's Closer to Truth without the. So a very significant difference. And it's not closest, it's closer to truth, .com. So www.closertotruth.com is the website. The show is on mostly PBS. Some other non-PBS stations carry it as well, about 180 stations in the U.S. and some foreign countries. Not always the best time. Sometimes it's late at night or mid-morning on a weekday, but, you know, for we're
get the DVR working.
Happy to take whatever time we can get, because it's clearly something that is not necessarily reality television for the masses.
Right, and hours and hours of video on demand through the website.
Yes, the website has the raw interviews that we had, which is maybe, you know, several hundred hours of with 128 people, but we've done another 50, so very soon we'll be at over 170, and then maybe by 200, and it'll be something like, right now it's about 1,300 videos, 8 to 15 minutes long each, and by next summer it could be as many as 2,000, so we've already done another 450, which haven't been posted yet, that will be coming up in the next few months, and, you know, we appreciate your, as well, kind of being with us and promoting the importance of this. If we disagree on some subjects, that's
right,
great.
Right.
But we both agree that to deal with these subjects is of high importance, and that's the most important thing.
Right, and underreported is the word that I think comes to mind, underappreciated. So it is an amazing body of work, and I certainly encourage everyone to check it out. If you haven't heard of Closer to Truth, or in particular, if you haven't heard of Closer to Truth lately and you heard of some of the older shows, the new ones, I got to tell you, are even better, if I can say, than some of the older ones you might have seen a few years ago on PBS. Dr. Kuhn, thank you so much for joining me today on Skeptico. It's been a real pleasure.
Alex, it's been a pleasure. Keep praying. Good work.
Thanks again to Dr. Kuhn for joining me today on Skeptico. You know, you'd think that after having been at this for a while, like I have, I wouldn't be so surprised by otherwise very intelligent people having a complete blind spot when it comes to NDE science. But I am constantly surprised, and I guess that's what keeps bringing me back to Skeptico and keeps me doing these interviews. I mean, as you've heard me say many times on the show, this argument against the near-death experience, that there is some other kind of brain activity that we can't measure with an EEG, is really one of the weakest possible arguments you can offer up. And yet, at the end of the day, a smart guy like Dr. Kuhn, that's the best he can come up with. Well, maybe that just means there's more work to do. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. If you'd like more information about the Skeptico show, please visit our website. It's at skeptiko. There you'll find links to all our previous shows, an email, a Facebook link to me. Please connect with me. And by the way, please tell your friends about Skeptico, blog about us, write about us, do whatever you might do. And that applies whether you're for me or against me. I just think it's great to engage in this dialogue about these important topics. Well, that's going to do it for today. I have a couple interesting shows coming up. I'm going to get to those as soon as I can. But until next time, take care and bye for now.